And welcome again, dear listeners, to Food Conversations Season 7. Now, before we begin, we must not forget that we are living and working in Xkrempukulu, the ancestral, unceded, and actually stolen lands of the Xkrempik people. It's clear that doing everything we can to resolve this situation is an important and necessary responsibility for every one of us. Now today, we're delighted to welcome a very energetic and accomplished advocate for healthy local food. Jordan Marr, along with his wife Vanessa, is co-owner of Unearthed Organics, a five-acre vegetable and herb farm located on Helen's Acres, and we're going to talk about Helen's Acres in a moment, in South Kelowna. Jordan is also the current president of the board of Organic BC, as well as a director of the North Okanagan Organic Association. And there's more, which we're going to talk about a bit later. Jordan, it's indeed a pleasure to welcome you to Food Conversations.
Thanks so much for having me, Warren.
It's a nice sunny day, and this is a sunny topic to talk about. So let's start with Helen's Acres, where your current farm is located. Now, Helen's Acres is a 24-acre swath of productive bottomland right in the middle of South Central Kelowna. It was donated in 2015 by a generous couple, Gordon and Helen Ziegler, with three goals: connect, which is establishing community; educate, which is teaching people about farming and growing food; and nourish, which is the whole process of feeding people. So why don't you just share with listeners a little bit about this beautiful and productive urban farmland and how you ended up on it? Because this wasn't your first farming venture in the South Okanagan.
No. So I came to the Okanagan in 2011 and established a lease in Peachland at the Homestead Organic Farm. And that was a wonderful place to be for around 6 years. But towards the end, my wife's career was changing and she found a new opportunity in Kelowna. And I was looking for more land and was available over there at the lease in Peachland. So I was looking around Kelowna and just kind of with some luck was connected with the folks, really the owner of this beautiful property, just a couple of stone throws from Orchard Park Mall, just to like kind of place it for people kind of yes. In Central Kelowna.
Yep.
The owner was just in the midst of finalizing a donation of the property as well as some startup funds to a charitable foundation in town, because towards the ends of his life and his wife's life, she had passed by then.
She was the
decided
Helen.
They wanted to.
She was Helen. Yes, of history.
She was Helen and wanted to make it available to the community. So where I came in is this was like at the complete beginning. And so the charity that received the land had a lot to figure out and figured that they in some ways make it simpler if they had one commercial grower on site. So that became me essentially. I took a piece of land at the back while they got established on the rest of the property, and they had a lot of work to do. Gordon and Helen had a real open door policy over the decades they had the property of allowing people to come and drop off unused and unwanted things. So there was a huge cleanup. Anyway, to see the transformation that has taken place at this community farm since then is honestly incredible. The cleanup they did, reclaiming the farmland. Yeah, go ahead.
Speaking of that cleanup, I think it was something like 1 million pounds of scrap of one sort or another. Is that an accurate figure?
Yes. There was a period when they had these reams of volunteers organizing everything that had to be removed, where you'd walk through the property and here's a mountain of propane tanks and here's a mountain of drywall and here's a mountain of choose your scrap. And then load by load, they took it away and have reclaimed the land. And now they are just pumping out food that mainly goes to different food recovery organizations, the food bank, stuff like that. It's really cool. So that's been like an extra perk of being here, is just kind of watching this take shape over the last, now it's been, I don't know, 7-8 years.
And I understand the volume that's coming out is literally hundreds of thousands of pounds of vegetables primarily.
It's a lot of food. Yeah. And a lot of, what's really cool is it's like your vegetables, you know, that you might predict, like potatoes. They've been an asparagus patch, been growing strawberries, they've been growing raspberries. So like really, really some of that kind of special premium high-end food also going to the food bank. that you know, because there's a they need a lot of hands to pick that stuff, and they're doing it. It's really cool.
The unique feature of this land is it's in an urban center. It's not, you know, the conventional view of farmland is it's outside the community, and then the community is a little homogeneous unit in the middle of all that. But you're farming right, as you say, a stone's throw away from major hotel properties in Kelowna. Does that give you an access to, say, a market that would, you don't have to travel, you know, kilometers away to, you know, you can travel kilometers away, but you also have a lot of people and businesses to whom you can sell that are close at hand.
Absolutely. Now, I want to establish that I've been in a real transition with my farming and my farm business, and I'm actually doing almost all of my farming now up in Armstrong. We can talk about that later if we want.
Sure.
Because I've moved with my family up to Vernon. But for the years I was here, Warren, one thing I really loved about being on a farm right on the rural-urban divide here in Kelowna is the way I've described it is if I turn a 360-degree spin, I'm looking at buildings over in the developed part of Kelowna. Then I'm looking at a whole bunch of farmland, and then I'm looking at the forested area of the Mission Creek Greenway, right? Like we're right along Mission Creek here in Kelowna. So yeah, depending on my mood, I can look in a different direction to get a different vibe each day when I'm farming here.
Helen's Acre, there's a aerial photograph of Helen's Acres on the website of Helen's Acres, and you can see exactly what you're describing, a whole sea of urban sprawl, and then right in the middle of this greened up area, which obviously, as you described it, was not always greened up. It was a bit of a repository for humanity's detritus. But now, of course, it's become this wonderful place of growing and community establishment. Now, the other side of your story, which I mentioned at the beginning, is that you're also involved with the bigger principles, the structures, the policies that animate farming, especially organic farming, as the current president of the board of Organic BC, which used to be called the Certified Organic Organization of BC, Association of BC. So you have kind of a unique perspective. You're actually on the ground pulling out, you know, hardy native perennials, but you're also looking at the picture that surrounds the world. So Organic BC, why don't we talk about it a little bit, because it's a pretty seminal organization regarding organic farming in this part of the world. The vision, it says, towards an organic British Columbia, the mission is to cultivate a resilient organic movement in British Columbia. So why don't you just lay out what you're, as the president, but also an engaged organic farmer, what you see that's all about there?
Well, so it's interesting. Organic BC fills a number of different roles in the organic sector. It's an organization. It's still called officially on paper, Certified Organic Associations of BC. We made what I think was a wise decision a few years ago to kind of rebrand publicly as Organic BC, a lot nicer off the tongue, and a lot more obvious what we do. But yes. It has a 30 year history. We celebrated our 30th anniversary in the last year, and so a few different functions. Part of it is just you know, I think the shopping public that say buys certified organic food probably doesn't give a ton of thought to all the work going on behind the scenes in terms of that food being certified. Yes. There's a fairly complex regime in place to certify the farmers, to verify that the farmers that are certified are doing what they say they're doing, but also an ongoing and regular review of the rules of organic agriculture that has to be happening almost constantly so that they can be updated to reflect, you know, new situations.
I was in the room a few years ago when the minister at the time of agriculture, which was not the NDP party's minister, stood in the room and said, we're going to make it mandatory for organic to mean in British Columbia that it is certified organic. In other words, it's not just a word that people put on it. Do you remember that time? Because that was a bit of a watershed for organic growing. It meant that you couldn't pretend that you didn't use a lot of pesticides, but you could call it organic. You couldn't do that anymore. Do you remember if that changed mindsets? It seemed to change mindsets in the room at the time. Lana Popham was standing right beside me, and she said, he's saying it was his idea. I've been nagging him for 7 years to do it.
Yeah, so this goes back to around, I think it's kind of came into effect with updated legislation around 2018. One thing I can remember is that there was some contention within the farming community and organic farming community, because what it essentially meant was that word was being more formally protected. And so that rubbed many people outside of the formal certification of organic agriculture the wrong way, because it's essentially saying, no, you can't use that word anymore in a lot of most contexts. A really common one, you can't call it organic in the grocery store if it's not certified. You can't even call your food organic at the farmer's market in BC if it's not certified anymore. So there were some real strong internal debates, but I think ultimately, I'm biased as a certified organic farmer, but a good development to protect and preserve the meaning of organic and to reflect the mountains and mountains and mountains of work, much of which is unpaid labor that went into building this movement and this, I'll call it, a brand over, 30, 40 years. I'm ultimately happy about it.
Organic BC is part of a much larger organization called the International Federation of Organic Agriculture Movements, or IFOAM, but closely linked, as are all organic organizations, by some basic principles. The principles that Organic BC affirms, and it says so explicitly on its website, is that the principles are things like health, human health and the health of the planet, ecology, fairness, the principle of care. In other words, you're caring for the way you do things. We're just going to talk about that a little bit more, but then I'll remind listeners that my guest today is Jordan Marr, who is the co-owner of Unearthed Organics and the president of the board of Organic BC. What I was getting at is there's a lot of principles and values. There's talk of principles and values at every step of the way in organic farming. It's not just produce and commerce and profit and loss, although that plays a significant role in any farmer's life. But this emphasis on values and principles, talk about that a little bit, because undoubtedly that plays a role in the way you look at things too.
I think that what's always attracted me to organic agriculture is that for a long time, and still to a large degree, it was one of the only formalized approaches to agriculture that takes soil health as its first concern or first priority, and really lays that out as a foundational philosophy or priority, is taking care of the soil with the kind of assumption that if we do that, then good healthy food follows from that. And so that and all of the practices that come with trying to take care of the soil as we farm, like I say, is foundational. What's interesting, though, I really want to acknowledge, Warren, is that organic has come a really long way since it was kind of a kind of backlash or response to the industrialization of agriculture that happened through the mid 20th century, right?
Mm, for sure.
And it grew. So it started out in these little pockets, right? Like if we just take BC as an example, it was different. This is, we're going back to the late 80s, early 90s, different farmers of specific regions who were starting to embrace these practices and then talking about those practices, say at the farmer's market. And so that then the word organic starts to take on meaning for shoppers. But then you face the problem of, okay, how do we need to standardize a meaning here, right?
Yes.
So I'm just taking you through that evolution of, so some farmers in the Fraser Valley or the Okanagan get together and say, let's agree what we mean by organic and what those practices mean.
What it led to was the establishment of a whole range of certifying organizations, mostly on the same path, but with subtle differences here and there. The COABC was a group of certifying organizations. Now there's there's a Canadian standard, there's a U.S. standard, although it's obviously threatened by commercial, large-scale commercial operations to a great extent. But now there's sort of national standards, and you could transition to organic BC and just say organic BC, organic is organic. It's not this person's organic or that person's organic. It's a kind of an agreed upon set of principles.
Yeah, and that's sort of what I was speaking to just a moment ago, is that as with any movement that takes on mainstream appeal, right, it has to make some compromises along the way. And you just referenced, you know, in spite of the presence of very commercial agribusiness interests in organic. Well, yeah, that's been, organic became big business around the world, right? And so one thing that's interesting, just going back a little further, like a few minutes ago in our conversation, you're talking about those, asking me about those foundational principles. What I wanted to underscore is that those principles never went away, but organic at the same time has had to standardize things so that organic can mean the same thing effectively around the world, so that when someone in Taiwan or the UK buys organic cherries from the Okanagan, that those organic cherries can hold that designation and mean something around the world.
There are now international organizations as well, like Quality Assurance International, and these organizations have to stake their reputation on actually doing their job. But they, of course, they certify materials and foods that come into the country from outside. So there has to be a congruence, a kind of a global congruence, which IFOAM, of course, endorses. And that's part of this this growth, as you say, this movement towards a clearer enunciation of what the principles of organic are.
Yeah, I wanted to just highlight the tension that now exists between those foundational principles and some of the criticism that comes from outside the sector currently. One criticism I hear regularly is like, well, organic has sold its soul and it has just become a list of what you can't put on your farm, right? Like you can't use this pesticide or you can't use this soil amendment. I think that's an oversimplification personally.
As president of Organic BC, you can say that, yeah, for sure.
I want to use your platform since we're talking about it, just to say that organic has not abandoned those core principles, and they're still tied in with every organic farmer certification in the process of remaining certified. But it would be too cute of me to say that organic in growing to become this world recognized brand has not had to make some compromises like any other movement does when it kind of reaches the mainstream.
As a physician, I've been very involved in the health side of food because I actually bought a nutrition textbook shortly after I started my practice here in Salmon Arm, and food, a knowledge about the health impacts of food has been an important part of what I talk to patients about. It's interesting to see how the evolution of my profession has paralleled to some degree the evolution of the organic movement and organic farmers, because for the longest time, if you were a doctor in the community, you were just called a GP, a general practitioner. And then along comes the College of Family Physicians and says, well, it's not just the doctor who couldn't become a specialist who becomes your community physician, somebody who has a whole different set of functions in the community. Look at the whole person. You deal with complexity. And the old GPs were enraged initially. Like, you're just telling us that we have to do this and we have to do that. And it seems to me that process is what you're describing now, that there was sort of a random aspirational movement that coalesced, and as it coalesced, agreements come forward and shared understanding comes forward. And pretty soon you have some principles that are pretty clear and fairly explicit. And then there are people who criticize that. And they're usually people in competition with you. In the United States, there's always large commercial operations infringing on the USDA's regulations about organic. And I think it does happen here a little bit too still, doesn't it? That people say, we're really organic, you're just giving us a hard time.
Well, so that's what's interesting about the protection of the word that came into force a few years ago in BC. That's happening a lot less now. But what I would say, like, I think the lens through which to look at your observation question is the rise of the word regenerative to describe what in many cases are very similar practices. And on the one hand, I mean, you can divide proponents and advocates of regenerative agriculture who are, say, who are not certified organic. You can divide them into camps. Some are just disenchanted former organic growers who really do believe that organic made too many compromises on its way to worldwide understanding and appeal. Some are, I would argue, fit in that camp of, still want to be able to, there's a lot of greenwashing that happens in certain pockets of the regenerative movement where you've got claims being made that are completely unverified. And so it provides cover for those who want to get in on the sustainability kind of bandwagon and the premiums that can come with it in the marketplace.
And, you know, that's a sign of success when people are trying to bend the rules because they want to affiliate themselves with a movement, but they don't want to have to follow all the rules, which are often hard won. They've taken a long time to develop, and they're detailed and they're precise. And yet there's always people who think, well, maybe we can do it better without following the rules.
Something about me, I've observed about myself that I am often almost always harder on my own community than on externally. And I think the organic movement, the organic sector deserves a little bit of blame for the rise of regenerative and some of that blowback, because it rose to prominence and kind of got to rest on its laurels, and kind of the public is always going to simplify things because people don't have enough time to really delve in. If I'm talking about the public writ large, right?
Yep.
And so what kind of happened at some point is people really started to associate organic with no spray, right? Which isn't even like factually quite correct, but no spray, let's just go with that oversimplified definition of organic. And I think organic as a movement too much just kind of allowed that to happen rather than emphasizing and hammering home, no, it's about a bunch more than that, these foundational principles, kind of asleep at the wheel, sort of to some degree. And that's to allow, that's made room for that criticism and that surge of a word like regenerative.
The essence of organic is a holistic approach. I think that's what I think you're saying. It's a holistic approach,
yep,
which has many dimensions. And it's interesting because from a health point of view, there are two things that distinguish organic foods when people eat. One is that you don't have a burden of chemical contaminants that are harmful to your health lurking in the unlabeled part of the food content. And the second is that it actually tastes better. And I remember when I read that, it was a document put up by the Soil Association, which is the British organic organization. And they had done a study and showed that there wasn't a lot of evidence, but what there was showed that defense compounds in plants, which are not protected by artificial pesticides, are much more abundant, and they have the flavor. They mean that it actually does taste better. And those kinds of principles, which were not the foundational principles of organic growing, nevertheless, from a point of view of a consumer, are really helpful. Like, I'm not going to kill myself by eating this stuff, and I'm going to actually enjoy the flavor more than I would if it was just protected by all those chemicals.
I think the science around plant defense and some of those phytochemicals is really fascinating. I will say that I don't grow carrots anymore, and I buy all of mine from Four Elements Farm in Oyama, which is a certified organic farm. And
surprise, surprise.
Some of the best carrots I've ever tasted. Honestly, they're very sweet. However, I also don't like, while I agree with you, I most of the produce I eat is organic, and I search out really tasty stuff. But there's the ecosystem of a farm, and the soil is so complex that you can still find your conventional carrots that taste wonderfully sweet. And I always like to say that it's never black and white with such things, because the growing environment is so complex.
Well, as we all know, nothing is ever black and white, and that's probably just as well. Nuance is everything, and we'll talk about that maybe a little bit at some point about a poster you had. Why don't we talk about it now? That poster you had that down to nuance or something like that, when there was a protest on a lamb farming operation, and you waded in with a poster.
This is a few years ago now. It's just down the Greenway, just down Mission Creek from me on the bicycle path. I had an employee who also had his own farm down there. He raised lamb and they slaughtered lamb on the farm. Had announced an open farm day just to invite the community out to come and check out the farm. And that also attracted the attention of some animal rights groups, or an animal rights group here in Kelowna, and they announced their intention to come and protest. And I support all forms of protest. I was personally frustrated. My own view is that the standards of animal welfare happening at their farm were so much higher than what comes out of the mainstream meat production system that I felt like they were just kind of picking on this little local farm, and I'd rather see them at the parking lot in Costco trying to eliminate that meat before they go and pick on my friends down the Greenway. So I went and I organized my own counter protest, and I went and held up some signs alongside them, kind of as a bit of mockery, I guess. I joined them as if I was with them as in their protest, and my sign said down with Nuance. And I had another sign that said, we love Costco meat.
Jordan, did they get it? Did they get that there was irony in what you were doing, or were they too wildly enthusiastic?
No. You know what? Something interesting that happened is that, so I was too passionate that day. I was upset. So I went, and first of all, they were really bewildered. And then quickly realized, I think they realized, like, I wasn't there to actually protest with them. And they kind of, we got in each other's faces, and I started a chant. But I'm also a big guy, and quickly realized that I was coming across as intimidating. And so we all just calmed down then and actually had a conversation. That was a cool result of it.
Always the best result.
We sat down on the ground and just talked it out. I don't think we ended up agreeing, but at least we got away from the yelling at each other.
You became civilized, like we all aspire to be.
Yeah. After the initial bit, it went better.
I remind listeners once again that I'm speaking with Jordan Marr, who's the co-owner of Unearthed Organics and the president of the board of Organic BC. Now, Jordan, in my notes that I made before the show, I put down the next sentence, which is, Jordan is a prolific communicator. And I think if any listeners haven't understood that aspect of your personality, they would have been half asleep, because it's obvious that when you focus your attention, you really have a capacity to share information. And that's led to you, in fact, formally engaging in a regular and very enthusiastic process of communicating about farming. You do it, first of all, on your own website, the website of your own business, Unearthed Organics, and you have a blog, which we'll talk about in a moment, but also you have a whole series of blogs on the Organic BC website. And furthermore, as if that was not fulfilling enough, you also do some shows on Daybreak South, the CBC morning show from Kelowna with Chris Walker. Why don't you talk about that side of your interaction with food and organics? This notion of communicating widely about all aspects of farming.
Yeah, for sure. So it's noteworthy on this topic that I come from a non-farming background, Warren. And so when I got into farming,
I'm going to make a reveal here. Your father was a well-experienced lawyer.
That's right.
And he trained you.
My dad's a lawyer, retired lawyer. My mom's a retired teacher. I grew up with no connection to food. Got interested in farming starting in around 2002 to 2003, I guess. But when I finally got into farming, I lacked a lot of skills. And then meanwhile, as a guy in my early to mid 20s, for the first time, I took an interest in public radio, really started listening to the mother corp, so to speak. And so along with my kind of burgeoning at the time interest in farming, I had this interest in broadcasting. And so at that point, well, a few years after that, around 2011, 2012 is when I started a farming podcast. And for me, it was great because it allowed me to pursue this interest, but also get people on the phone that that maybe otherwise wouldn't give me the time of day. And I got to interview them for this podcast. And
so
that was great.
If this is the podcast on your own website, it's called The Ruminant. Lovely picture of a logo of a cow in the exact pose of Rodin's, Auguste Rodin's The Thinker. Tell me the story of that. That's such a beautiful image.
Yeah, I mean, it's a pretty simple story. I don't remember how and why I decided I wanted to call the podcast and the blog that went with it The Ruminant, other than the obvious connotations I was going for.
Ruminating.
And it's that's right. And it's kind of that double entendre of referencing agriculture, but also ruminating. And I don't know. It popped into my head, this idea of a cow in the pose of Rodin's The Thinker. So that's how it came to be. I'm proud of that one, actually.
I think you should be. I think it's beautiful. And the subtitle of your blog site is Pondering the Best Way to Agriculture, a podcast and blog for hungry minds. Hungry minds. There's no question that language, the training school at home between your teacher mother and your lawyer father, was one to use words to convey things.
Yeah, well, thanks for that. You're too kind. So off I went with The Ruminant, and it was a hobby project, off again, on again, off again, over really to this day, although The Ruminant podcast is a little quieter lately. I have a new podcast as of early 2024 called Farming in British Columbia, and that's where I've been putting a lot of my effort. That and the Organic British Columbia podcast that I also host. So
please don't let that logo disappear from the multiverse. It's too good. On this blogging site that you have now, The Ruminant, you've covered a lot of ground. And some of the things, just to give listeners an idea, rotational grazing. Okay, that's pretty straightforward. The next one after that was called Farming is Gay. And you interviewed a number of gay and lesbian farmers who are very much part of the industry, but of course deal with special issues because of people's response to sexual orientation, that kind of thing. Then the next one was, or a little further down, was The Biggest Little Disappointment. And that's about the film called The Biggest Little Farm. Why don't you talk about that a little bit? Because it highlights an aspect of your thinking, which is farming is somewhere you have to make a living. And the film, especially the sequel, didn't really cover that. It just didn't show the struggle that farmers go through.
Yeah, there was a documentary about farming called The Biggest Little Farm on Netflix that I think it was early pandemic, maybe when it was really big. I had many non-farmers in my life approaching me. Have you seen this film? Have you seen this film? It's amazing. And it really is. It's beautiful. It's like a feast of the eyes. But it also, I think, was guilty of painting an unrealistic picture of the reality of farming for most people. I think it was a farm with a lot of funding behind it, and the documentary really didn't go into the economics of what they were doing. And so I did a podcast episode about that.
And the Disney sequel, anything you'd like to say about the Disney sequel that we can play over the radio?
It was bizarre. It was just, it was bizarre. It was, it seemed to be Disney thought, Netflix has lost the rights to this. This was really popular. Let's get another 10 minutes of attention. And they did this bizarre follow-up that really just felt like an extended trailer for a real documentary that never came. So that was really interesting.
A real happy documentary where everybody was smiling all the time.
Yeah.
You also had things on, for example, the relationship between agribusiness on a large scale, which is purely commercial, and farmers in real time, especially if they were on a small farm. Big Chicken, Indebted Farmers. That's a very evocative title. Just could you give the essence of what that show was about?
Yeah, and I have to say I can't remember now if that was my title or if I borrowed it from the work of
it's
the
a good title
I interviewed.
Who cares?
Yeah, so one thing that The Ruminant, I love about The Ruminant podcast is that I really set it up to allow me to go in almost any direction I want, right? So that's why you have an episode about rotational grazing, and then you can have one about the experience of LGBTQ farmers, right? In that case, sometimes I'm just reading something online that's really interesting to me. And I found out about the experience of contract poultry producers in parts of the United States growing for, you know, one of the two or three giant poultry producers that dominate, like, you know, an insane percentage of the market. And so that's how that one came about, and just learning how unfair those contracts are for many of those farmers.
But your point about covering anything you want, you've already carried that over into the Organic BC podcast, which things like robotic weeding. I mean, robotic weeding, it's not the thing that people think about when they think about organics, and yet why not? Controlling weeds with electricity. A couple of things on IPM in a changing climate. Now that's getting down to some of the nitty-gritty of what people are having to deal with in the world of growing. Everybody, it doesn't matter who you are and what way you grow. The climate crisis is impinging on a lot of things that happen. Why don't you just talk about that a little bit? I've seen some stuff recently that shows how devastating or unusual climate events and extreme weather events can be for farmers.
Yeah, I really can't be the only guest in your recent list to
you
talk about this.
You are not.
Yeah, I really there is like a level of anxiety or malaise that exists among a lot of farmers right now because of the conditions we're encountering. It's so funny to think about my entrance into farming in around 2005, 2006, 2007, talking to a farmer who was about to retire, who really paid attention to science, and him speculating what he felt was to come with the unpredictability. And everyone in the public hears about that, the unpredictability that will come with climate change. But on the ground, on the farms, that just means these shocks of extreme weather that the crops we grow are just not accustomed to handling, you know. And so here in the Okanagan, just what's that meant? I mean, the one everyone can relate to is just what's happening on vines and fruit trees right now.
Yes.
And it's having a cumulative effect, you know, in terms of these, like, this cold snap and this heat dome and this storm and whatever, it's really starting to build up consequences, I guess. I'm thinking specifically of tree fruit growers right now, but you could apply this to many different types of farming.
One of the things you talked about when we were discussing the blogosphere that you play a significant role in was the fact that a goal was to break down isolation of one group and another, the so-called silo phenomenon, where people get involved in something and they don't pay any attention to anything else. And with reference to the climate change process, which, despite some people who are not very scientific saying it just means the planet's getting warmer, well, that'll be fine. We'll have longer summers and shorter winters. Well, unfortunately, extreme weather events come along with this process, and they're an integral part of it. And that's been shown by a couple of scientists about 25 years ago. They predicted, one Canadian, one American, both women, wrote a paper saying the model says extreme weather events will be central to this process. When that's happening, it means everybody is under duress. And so breaking down silos, in a way, is the integral part of us learning to collaborate, of us learning to say, okay, we're not isolated. We have to work with one another. If we don't work with one another, we're going to be in big trouble. Why don't you talk about that principle? Because I think it's essential to what you've been doing.
So to talk about that principle, I want to say that something that is meaningful to me or important to me is to really try and avoid morality-based discourse when we talk about farming. Mm-hmm. I at the same time that I'm grateful for the more radical contingent of my farming circles, the ones that really try and push change, what often comes along with being radical is bringing morality into the arguments we're making about this food is the right way to grow food and this food is the wrong way. And I think a consequence of that is siloing, we form in groups and out groups, say within the farming community, big versus small, organic versus conventional. And I I'm a moderate at heart, I guess. And so, yeah, for me, it's really trying to avoid those dichotomies of good, bad, big, small, that sort of thing that I think is too pervasive in these conversations.
No, and I agree completely with you, because it is a way, it's a very human tendency to form a group and then create an in-group. Every indigenous community around the world had a name for itself that said the people. We are the center of our universe, and therefore that's the whole universe. And I think all of us do it to some extent. My profession is notoriously self-centered and siloed, if you like, apart from the community at large. And so it's a tendency that we all have to address. And climate change is compelling us to abandon that narrowness of approach. I just remind listeners once again that I'm speaking with Jordan Marr, the co-owner of Unearthed Organics and the president of the board of Organic BC. So we're talking about the breadth of change that's taking place in our world right now, and the changes that have taken place in your own life, which are very typical of pretty much every guest that's ever been on the show, are really significant. Started off growing up in Kamloops, your father was a lawyer, your mother was a teacher, farming was not on your radar, but you did grow up in a family where argumentation and critical thinking was sort of in the air. It was sort of around and about everywhere. Would that be fair to say?
Yeah, I grew up in a family of talkers, both my younger brothers are incredibly well spoken. Both sides of my parents' family are full of talkers. And then meanwhile, it was something my dad just hammered home through all of my brothers' adolescence was the importance of developing critical thinking, to the extent that I got super anxious about it, you know, because I kept wondering when I was going to wake up and be a critical thinker. It didn't appreciate as a 15-year-old that it was something that you earn slowly over time. And I like to think I got there.
Well, I can tell you, listeners are now going to know that you have gotten there. So I can, on behalf of the entire listenership to this show, I'm going to have to tell you that I think you've achieved that goal. But you didn't go into farming. You went to TRU, Thompson Rivers University. And I can't remember if you switched to UBC and then got interest in kinesiology, or were interested in kinesiology before you went. Why don't you clarify that salient point in your life history?
Yeah, I mean, I was 19, 20 years old. I had a couple years of sciences under my belt at TRU. I was stressed out, as many people that age are, about what I was going to do with my life. Actually, it was medicine that I had in mind, Warren. I thought, like, what a noble pursuit. And I also was obsessed with athletics. I was a triathlete and a mountain biker. And so I went into kinesiology, and that lasted about a year. After 1 year, I realized it wasn't for me. And really, at the same time, being at UBC in Vancouver, just got exposed to a whole bunch of new ideas and started to rethink what I wanted to do with,
you also had an opportunity to become part of a program, a special kind of program at UBC, not the kind of program that happens all the time. Leading to a program leading to an interdisciplinary science degree under the aegis of the Faculty of Agriculture. What was unique about that program? There's some number of things.
Well, I don't know if it's as unique anymore, but at the time it really incorporated flexibility, this program, to go and pursue subjects within the degree and really build your own degree. I mean, when I'm being self-deprecating, I call it a really hippy-dippy degree. But it was just really appealing for me to go and justify taking courses from all around the university. But it was located somewhat, you could argue, bizarrely, in the Faculty of Agriculture. You didn't have to make farming at all a focus in this degree. And that set the course of my adulthood, because I ended up getting really interested in farming and stuck with it, which was completely unexpected.
Let me tell you, as a qualified health professional, that food is very important to survival. I do not think you have to qualify the fact that it was under the Department of Agriculture. It's the movie that Suzanne Crocker, a family physician in Dawson Creek, did about living locally on local food was called First We Eat. and then we do everything else. That's a quotation from an author, but I think that was a really good idea to situate it there. But it was a unique quality of being able to have choice over the material you studied, diversify your program according to the things that really fascinated you. I'm sure that must have been from a kid from a talkative family with lawyers and teachers lurking in around every corner. It must have been an opportunity to really have a lot of fun.
It was. I found my people at the university. I found a really great community, and I feel like I thrived in that program. It was, you know, it wasn't giant, right? It was a small program within a smaller faculty, and so really made some great friends. And yeah, as you say, a lot of good opportunities. And when I exited, I had an idea that I would get a master's degree and one way or the other try and make change within food systems, but I wanted to make a side stop on a farm so that I had a little more credibility, since I'd never been on one really, and that cemented something new for me, which was like an actual interest in farming.
So you went to Nova Scotia for 6 months and worked on a farm, but you also, you said you found your people, you found your wife, your future wife, in the program as well.
That's right. Yeah, I met Vanessa in that program, and when we finished, we decided to go and get some experience on a farm. And what came from that was then a couple more years of working on farms, and then ultimately the two of us deciding to start a farm business. And that's what brought us to Peachland in 2011.
That's right. And that was 6 years, and then you moved on to your own farm in Kelowna, and now you're moving on further north to another property. So change seems to be part of what all of us need to do in responding to what's going on in the world around us and in our own lives. And I think it's an element that, for people who have hoped for a staid, consistent, uninterrupted path in their lives, they're probably going to have to do some rethinking. And I think the way you've done things is a clear indication that that can be a very satisfying thing to do, to keep changing as you see things differently. Now, one thing you mentioned earlier briefly, that your wife had trained and is now practicing as a midwife. And as soon as we started to talk about that, of course, it popped into my head that there's something deeply parallel about someone being a midwife and someone being a farmer. You're both creating life or participating in the creation of life. And you added a couple of points that I think were quite relevant. One is that there's a result. It's a tangible thing. When you attend the birth of a child, there is a child in front of you that wasn't there in the room before, was there but was not immediately visible. And when you're growing food, you plant seeds and seedlings, and then you have this acreage or this field full of growing things. And the other thing you said was that both of these disciplines or professions are not time-based. You have no control over the time sequence of events in either midwifery or in farming.
Yeah. So one thing that first of all, they've turned out to be very compatible vocations, just in terms of two people making a life together. It's worked out well. In both cases, a very direct line between the work we put in and the outcome or the production per se. Right. I think Vanessa started the farm business with me before she became a midwife. And I think for both of us, there was a real appeal for that link between our work and the output to be very tangible and very short. You know, compared to, and that's what I tend to hear from friends who have taken different paths. Say just picture, I'm gonna create a cliche, but the friend in my life who's working an office job and maybe reconsidering, often the complaint they have is that it's the work they do is too abstract or even sometimes feels meaningless. And then that's not a problem. Our own midwifery and farming come with plenty of challenges, but feeling not meaningful or feeling intangible is not one of the problems we have, for sure.
There are also processes that are very basic to the human species. One is welcoming new members into the fold, and the other is welcoming those other species on which we depend wholly for our survival into the world as well. You're bringing them forward and then sharing them with other people. It seems it's there are many fairly profound values that are embedded in both the profession of midwifery, and I hope you'll tell Vanessa that I'm a great fan of midwives and practiced attending childbirth for 25 years and stopped when midwifery became an accepted profession in this province. But there's the same fundamental values implied in them. Now, you have two sons. You have Levin and August. And I wonder if having two young sons, has intensified or changed or altered in any way your sort of perspective on what you do and why you do it.
I don't think I needed that perspective changed. I can tell you, are you a father, Warren?
No, but no. I know lots of kids.
I certainly have had my perspective changed. I certainly thought I knew what I was going to expect with parenthood and have had so many of my assumptions corrected, you know, but
a wry smile, ladies and gentlemen, on Jordan's face.
Yeah, this is the portion of the episode where we get into extreme cliche mode, I suppose. But when you combine having entered middle age and also being the parent of a 7-year-old and a 4-year-old, I'm in extreme like, oh, it really does happen how everyone says, you know, just in terms of not having how age comes for all of us. Age comes for all of us. So there's that, and also just being humbled by what I thought, what I brought into parenting versus what I had to change about the way I parent to try and, you know, bring up good kids.
When you look at the food that you're growing, do you have a sense that you're growing food in a way that would be suitable to give to your children?
I certainly have taken a lot of joy in having the kids out in the fields. I mean, back when I was growing like lots of different kinds of veggies, for example, to just walk through the fields and have the kids treat it like a salad bar was pretty fun. Have a kid, you know, one of my favorite videos of Levon is him picking an ear of corn, of sweet corn, and shucking it in the field and eating it raw, which is how we tend to eat it in our family. Try it, folks. It's really good. You don't have to cook your sweet corn.
Yes, indeed.
That's been really rewarding. And the fact that Levon knows what a hackerai turnip is, you know, and knew from a very young age is got a kick out of that.
You know, the energy that a person brings to what they do is often conditioned by what's going on in a person's mind. And if your mind is sort of dark and focused on stopping things, it leads to a bit of a dead end. But your mind is focused on growing and expanding and changing and doing all sorts of things like that. I think it shows in the kind of discourse that you engage in. And today, I think it's been really obvious to listeners that A, you have an active mind, and B, you put it to work to do things that I think most people would find admirable, and probably some of your office inhabiting friends would be saying, gee whiz, maybe we should try that. Let's look a little further than what we're doing with all the paperwork and the digital communication. I want to thank you, Jordan, for being on the show. I want to thank you for sharing your journey, but also your perspective, because I think it's one that a lot of people share. Certainly people who listen to this show are very attuned to the kinds of values and principles that you are working hard to espouse. So thank you again, and one day we may have you back on the show to talk about all those other things that we didn't talk about today.
I really appreciate the opportunity to come on. It's a great show. I can't believe the list of people you've talked to in this community. It's awesome.
Well, you've now joined that list, and you may be a very prominent person we'll be talking about again. Anyway, take care. Thank you.
Thanks a lot.